Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, episode 118, recorded July 1, 2011. Hot news, cold peanuts. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly, all streamed directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, go to netflix.com/twit. And by squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to create a high-quality website or blog. For a free trial and 10% off your new account for 6 months, go to squarespace.com and use offer code TWIL7. Hi, folks. It's Denise Howell, and you've tuned in for This Week in Law, episode 118. We're thrilled to have you here. We have a ton of stuff to talk about. It's been a really busy and interesting week, and we've got a great panel to go over all of it with. We have a special guest this week, T. Jason Agnello. Am I saying that right, Jason?
It's Agnello. Thanks.
Agnello. There we go. Who is formerly also known as the Peanut Tweeter. Very humorous and wonderful guy whose very humorous and wonderful Tumblr blog got taken down under the provisions of the DMCA. So we want to get your firsthand impressions of going through that process and an update on anything that might be new on that front, Jason. And we really appreciate your joining us on the show.
Thanks. It's so nice to be in with some esteemed company here. Probably undeserved, but it's great to be here. Thank you.
Very deserved. If anybody has not checked out Peanut Tweeter, I don't know how much there is to still check out, maybe in Google's cache, and we have a few cached images we can put up a little bit later. But the work you were doing there was just so hysterically funny, and I'm still a huge fan of the other funny projects you have going on, Death Star Help on Twitter being perhaps my other favorite, where the tweeting entity is a protocol droid fluent in 6 million languages, including Bocce, mercilessly relegated to taking help desk calls at Imperial Resort and Suites, a.k.a. the Death Star. So definitely worth checking that out as well. Also joining us, finally, we've been trying to get David on the show the last 3 weeks, but Skype has not been smiling on us. Let's hope. Fingers are crossed.
I got both mine crossed right here. Let's hope that it works this time.
Yes, we have David O'Brien from Technically Legal. Hello, David.
Hello, hello, and it's so great to be here.
Fabulous to see you after all this effort. We're glad you could join us, and I'm looking forward to getting your thoughts on all our stories this week. Also joining us, clean-shaven for a change, is Evan Brown. Hello, Evan.
Hey, how's it going? And if you'll remember, at the end of last week's show, we were talking about how we were just going to make David O'Brien the honorary phantom guest every week. So I'm glad, you know, I'm glad to see that we didn't actually go through with that, but we can actually have him here. So that's pretty awesome. But thanks a lot for having me. Happy Friday to you, and I'm looking forward to our conversation as always.
Me too. Yes, I think that maybe David should just be our invisible head. We can always just toss it up there and say, what would David do, or what would David think, and speculate at will.
I wanted to send you a cardboard cutout.
Yeah, exactly. We'll just put you behind me instead of my fireworks-oriented 4th of July flower arrangement here. That
those are very nice.
I get it now. In the house this week. Yes.
Yeah, see the fireworks.
Exactly. Fireworks in the daytime. All right. Well, I want to start off with something that the three of the four of us are using and is new this week and much on my mind because it is highly addictive. We were telling Evan, who is the one person on the panel who hasn't been kicking the tires on Google Plus, that once he starts playing with it, he should just accept the fact that several hours of his day for the next several days are going to be taken up by nosing around in there, because it's a really compelling user experience, I think, and quite fun to play with. Google Plus. But the reason I bring it up on our show is I have been really, really impressed out of the gate with the way they handle privacy and sharing and all of the things that Facebook has taken such flack about over the years. It really seems like the engineers at Google have been watching and paying attention and learning from their bad experiences with the rollout of Buzz on the privacy front, and trying to correct all that and coming up with a product that gives a lot of user control and a sense that, you know, you can really put things up there absent any sort of, you know, hacking data release kind of incident, that the people in charge of managing the data are going to respect your wishes as a user, which I think is such a nice breath of fresh air. Jason, you've been in there kicking the tires. Do you share my sentiments on that front?
You know, I think so. I've gotten a chance to look at it a little bit, add some people in circles, and just kind of look around a bit. Haven't really gone into the privacy issues of it, or benefits, as it were. But if it's anything better than Facebook, I'm on board with it.
All right. David, what do you think?
Well, it's not Facebook, and it's just like Facebook, just like XKCD noted this week. I think it's pretty cool. It's very minimalist. I really appreciate that about it. And as you noted, the way that they've approached privacy this time is much different than they did with Buzz. It seems like you have very granular controls. And also, they gave this great comprehensive guide about how you can handle your privacy on Google+.
Right. It all seems to make sense to me. There was a story right after it launched that it had experienced its first privacy issue, which had to do with the fact that you can look at somebody's post and share it. There's a share button, and all that does is put it into your own stream or on your own wall, associate it with your profile. And the idea there that it might be a privacy issue is that perhaps it was, you know, a photo of someone's child or something that they did not, you know, intend to be shared with the public or a wider field of people beyond their own circles, and that it would be if someone else shared it with all of their friends and friends of friends, etc. It sort of lets the horse out of the barn, if you will. However, there is a very big, you know, exclamation mark, highlighted in yellow warning in the privacy guide that lets you know that if you want to limit that sharing, you have to affirmatively do that. That is the one thing that I've found that is not that is a default that lets information out there. All the rest of it seems to be expressly opt-in. So this is the one exception to that I've seen. And you know, I don't know if they'll correct it. They've certainly heard from, I believe the Financial Times wrote about it, and different folks have taken them to task for that. So that's just a matter of, I think, probably flicking a switch and making it so that the sharing preferences, or you know, you could set some defaults or do it on a post by post basis, or maybe the users just need a little bit more information. Evan, are you excited to try this out?
I am, just because, you know, if there's anybody who can launch a viable alternative to Facebook, it's Google. And so, you know, given the fact that they can go about privacy intelligently, and they, you know, Google knows a thing or two about managing information and making it findable and making connections along the way, I'm excited to try it out. And it's just, you know, just kind of circumstantial why I haven't. You know, I have every intention of hopping on there as soon as I can. That's an interesting phenomenon, what you're talking about there with this ability to essentially just, I guess, just repost. I don't know what the nomenclature of Google Plus is going to be. Is it a post? Is it a, you know, an update or whatever? Well, but, you know, this whole notion of making information that's intended to be private by the original propagator of it, having it easy to be put out there, it's a phenomenon that we see in Twitter with the concept of somebody who has a locked account, a private account, you know, where you have to, you know, get the user's permission to subscribe to their feed or to follow them to get their updates on Twitter. And then, you know, there's no obstacle to retweeting that content. And there have been some entertaining stories along the way in the history of Twitter where information has gotten out that way. It's simply just a human vector, and there's really nothing technological you can do to stop somebody from copying and pasting a tweet and putting the RT in front of it. Right. I remember I saw, you know, something. It seems like law students have fallen victim to that breach of privacy. There have been some interesting situations like that where somebody's complaining about school, complaining about a classmate, and it all gets out there. So that's an interesting phenomenon, and it seems like, from what I understand, there could be an easily technological fix here. But I think in the end, it underscores the idea that it's the human layer that's ultimately going to determine, the human layer is going to be the ultimate privacy setting on these things.
Yeah, that's a great observation. And the other interesting phenomenon about all this is the timing of the field test, as they're calling it, of Google+, which is out to, I have no idea how many people, but enough people that I feel like it is a thrivingly populated place at this point. I get the sense that it will go viral very quickly because of the extent of Gmail penetration, that as soon as they've ironed out and opened up invitations for all of the people that are in there now, it's going to spread really quickly as people begin to add their entire contact list to their circles, which I think that they will want to do. So, it'll spread out like wildfire, I get the sense, once it's free to do so. And given that, it's interesting that the FTC is actively investigating Google right now for the extent of its domination of the web. It's with this product, it's sort of showing the conundrum that Google is in. It has to innovate in order to go forward and keep expanding into new areas. But, if its web domination now begins to extend to the social sphere as well, where it has not really been that prevalent before, the antitrust considerations here and abroad, they're facing a huge lawsuit now in Europe too, and all kinds of questions there. It puts them in an interesting position. David, any thoughts on that?
Google is getting enormous at this point. I think the last statistic I read is that they control something like 75% of U.S. search traffic. And if you consider the way that norms have changed over the last 10 or 15 years, we no longer really seem to rely on domain names to get around the internet. We instead just search for things on Google. We have a little search bar at the top of our browser. And what that seems to have led to is just everyone goes right to their search engine of choice, and for 75% of people in the U.S., that's Google, to try to find new things. But it gives them enormous power to control things, especially, with regard to how people get around the internet or whether they're looking for new and interesting businesses.
Right. It really feels like Plus that they have accomplished this Google operating system notion that we've heard about for years, simply because of its tight integration with all the rest of the Google services. And, something as small as the fact that they've changed, their fonts and look and feel so that it's a similar experience across the board. Gmail looks different now. Search looks different now. And it all looks like Plus. I don't know. It's starting to feel like a very unified experience, which starts to remind me of the trouble that Windows had back in the day when all of their various components were bundled together, and that wound up being a very huge antitrust problem for them. Evan, do you think this is a bad timing decision or just something you have to do as a large publicly traded web-oriented company?
It should come as no surprise that they are doing it. They certainly can. They have the ability to do it. Google is always innovating, so there's no reason why we should be surprised. And I'm no antitrust lawyer, and I only have a vague understanding of the doctrines that underlie antitrust protection. But it almost intuitively seems that Google could make the argument that it is not a major player in all areas of the web, because I'm sure it's going to be a while before Google's dominance of this particular space, being social networking, it's going to be a long time before it approaches the 700 million users and has the active engagement of the mainstream web. So It seems to me that you could make the argument that this actually stands for the proposition that Google is not such a monolith, not such a giant, but there actually are bigger participants in this, and therefore those who are the watchdogs in terms of antitrust concerns, you know, there really should be nothing for them to worry about. That will probably change in the course of the next few months or the next year. You know, certainly in the time frame for how an investigation would roll out. But I guess that presents the question, you know, how much should we be concerned about antitrust things? How much care should we give to be concerned about those things if they haven't really manifested yet? Perhaps those antitrust concerns are just at best inevitable at this point.
David, Facebook certainly has all the traction. We're all there. Our families are all there. Our distant connections from high school and college are all there. Do you think it's a compelling enough thing to come out with a new social networking tool that does present these more fine-grained and intuitive privacy kind of controls? Is that going to be enough to that coupled with the strength of I guess the Gmail contact universe, that people are going to add people in and at least get their, you know, address books checking this out. Is that going to be enough to pull people away from Facebook?
Maybe. I think it depends a lot on how people perceive Facebook. So they're not exactly one of the most liked brands in the universe right now. I think I heard Tom Merritt talking the other day on Tech News Today that they're something like the 10th or 11th most hated brand on the internet, or maybe even in general. And I think a lot of that stems from perceived privacy violations. As Facebook keeps removing privacy controls for its users, it sort of alienates a lot of them. So, but that might not be universal for all Facebook users. Maybe it's just those who seem to be most concerned with privacy controls, or those who are looking for jobs right now, something along those lines. And for those folks, I think they are looking for a viable alternative. And what you mentioned before, the Google ecosystem is really starting to grow now. And as the products get more integrated together, maybe it's not the case now, but somewhere down the line, it just makes sense to stay in the Google universe because all the products sort of integrate seamlessly together and they work together. So why should you go to another service? But you know, whether it's this new Google Plus is going to be compelling enough to get users out of Facebook, I can't say. You've got so many ties keeping you into Facebook. All your friends are there. You got your photos there. It's hard to remove things, and it's hard to, you know, just remove yourself from that that universe as well. So I could see people, you know, having two accounts at the same time, kind of like I'm doing right now. So that's another possibility. Well, I guess we'll just have to see where it goes.
Right. I understand from the studio the official most hated is Comcast, so the word on that. Two final observations about Google+. One thing along the lines of how the privacy universe there all works is I take it that the overarching Google privacy policy that applies to all of its services also applies to Google+. I don't think it has a separate policy. It's all part of the same package, which has been taken apart and put together again a lot recently. So it's gotten a lot of attention and I think has been brought up to snuff to the extent that it was not before. So what you're hit with in Google Plus is not some huge, incomprehensible document that is the privacy policy terms of use. Instead, you have this nice privacy guidelines. I take it it's, I don't know the exact formulation that it's coded in for the web, but it is a very nice user experience. It makes it very easy to pull up just the information you want on just the topic that you're looking for. And then there are just some nice user guidelines, very short, very straightforward about, you know, what you can and cannot do and how to report people who are violating those guidelines. And that's it. You don't have to get into the, what is it? There was that wonderful infographic of how dense and multi-paged the whole Facebook privacy documentation was.
It is longer than the Constitution, right?
Exactly.
Just a little bit.
So we seem to be getting away from that kind of a scenario here with Plus. So that's a very nice breath of fresh air. Something that wasn't so nice is what happened to Jason, and I want to get into that now in more detail. Jason, first tell us, how long was Peanut Tweeter around, and how did you come up with the idea to do it?
Basically, I wanted to do something as kind of an experiment with Twitter, and I was on it for a few years before I actually really did anything with it. But I thought Peanut Tweeter would be kind of a neat thing to do because you don't have a real personal experience, especially if you follow a lot of people. It's just kind of just this constant stream of, you know, people's tweets. Some of them are ridiculous, some of them are dark, and some, well, are really funny. And I wanted to kind of put that together and with something that some people can identify with. And I kind of kicked it around with different things, and I've come up, I saw the Garfield minus Garfield. I've been following that for a long time and thought that that was pretty interesting. Didn't want to do something like that, so I figured combining Peanuts, which everybody loves, at least my generation and previous ones, grew up on Peanuts, love them a lot, and I think the juxtaposition with Twitter, just random or nearly random Twitter post, and Peanuts kind of makes everything more interesting. It takes the hilarious Twitter posts and makes them even more so, and kind of the darker ones or the ones that are just absurd, even more dark and even more absurd. And everybody identifies with the Peanuts characters. Many identify with Lucy and Charlie Brown and Linus. So putting them in there kind of puts a face to what you would see in your Twitter feed, and it just makes it a more personal experience. And it's been, I developed it in early April, about April 4th or so, and it lasted about 10 weeks.
Mm-hmm. And how many followers were you up to?
Well, it was a Tumblog. So
right,
on Tumblr, it was about up to 3,500, and Twitter was about 4,600. And who knows, you know, how many people were just following along and not registered on anything.
Right. If we could, maybe the studio can put up a couple of sample Peanut tweets for people to see who didn't tune into our prior show where we discussed and put some of them up. If that's possible, please do so. Fair Burke in the studio. But the sad part about all this is you recently were contacted, or Tumblr, I guess, was contacted by the new owners of the rights to all the Peanuts brand and property. They're called Iconics, is that right?
Yeah, Iconics. It's Iconics Partner Group or something like that. Iconics Brand Group, thank you. And
right.
They own Peanuts Worldwide, which is the actual Peanuts company. So, but it's Iconics Brand Group.
And they did a DMCA notice to Tumblr, who removed the Tumblog, and that was that. Now, you've gotten some nice analyses from various people around the web, including the Yale Law and Technology Journal, I believe this is, who featured your saga as its fair use of the week and went through the various four factors under fair use as to why you have a pretty good case that this should not have been pulled down. Did you have any thoughts about perhaps going through the counter notice procedure and trying to reinstate this, or are you just so chilled by the whole idea of having to engage legally with this brand rights holding group that you decided not to do it?
Well, yes, and mm-hmm. yes.
You seem pretty chill anyway, Jason.
You're a very chill guy.
I originally started Peanut Tweeter just, you know, on a lark, just for laughs. I started doing it, and I showed my wife, and she thought they were hilarious. So, you know, I put it out there as a tumble log, and, you know, it just started getting a following. And the more bigger following I got, the more fun it was to do. And when this kind of takedown occurred by Tumblr, I was kind of like, okay, well, all right, you know, there it is, and I guess we're done. I got a lot of good comments and feedback about, you know, fighting this, and it is fair use and such. But like I mentioned before, you know, even if you do fight this, and even if you win, you lose, because I just couldn't bear the thought of having that kind of stress and such a long battle for something that was just for laughs. And quite frankly, you know, I've wrapped it up, and I'm ready to start something new. So, you know, that's what I like to do. And having a long going, you know, fight about this just doesn't seem worth it. As many fans as there are, and I'm appreciative of it, I'd like to do something new now.
Yep, that's understandable. Evan, what is your take on all this? It seems just a tragedy that something that seems to be on solid legal footing and really was, I think, in its own right, a creative effort that took and built upon the works of others in a way that the law actually is supposed to encourage. It's a tragedy that it's no longer with us. Do you agree? And is there any way forward or around this situation?
Yeah, I do agree that, you know, it's really a shame. You know, Jason, it was great work, and it's, you know, obviously very entertaining. And, you know, from the camp of folks like, you know, the folks who are on this show and listen to the show, who spend the time thinking about the legal issues that arise from it, it makes a very interesting and kind of, well, it makes a situation that really lends itself well to a discussion of fair use, because there's two ways of looking at it. No reasonable person, except maybe the Iconics folks here, is going to be really resolute in saying, you know, this is an infringement, this has got to stop, this is something that's just wrong, and it should not be permitted to continue. I think the vast majority of reasonable people are going to look at this as a situation where they'll say, oh my gosh, this is clearly a protected fair use, and nobody should be touching this, and it should be allowed to persist on the web, and it's, you know, it's a crime that it was taken down. Another subset of reasonable people would say, you know what, this is really a close case when it comes to fair use, because, you know, it does seem like there could be a market for the Peanuts comics, the original works. There could be a market to license those out to be reappropriated in a way that's like this. But that's still a close question because of the way that the other fair use factors way into this. This use is clearly transformative. It's for, you know, making a commentary. If you wanted to look at it, it's purely a commentary on Twitter and some of the inane and, you know, crazy stuff that comes out of there. And it's a bit of a commentary on, you know, Peanuts and the way that, you know, the way that they that the characters in there can kind of encapsulate the human spirit and human inquisitiveness and human wonderment and all of that stuff. So we've got those two situations, one where it's clear, you think it's clearly fair use, or at least it's a close case. And the thing that becomes really unfortunate about all of this, and this is an idea that I touched on in the show last week, I don't know if you heard it, but the fact that the way our system works here, there's really no meaningful way for someone in the remixer's position to fight this without investing a lot of resources, you know, financial resources, and what you mentioned was the stress involved with this. You know, if you were to do anything like this, I mean, I guess you could file the counter notification, but it wouldn't be too hard to get the stuff taken down again if they were to go to court and, you know, get an injunction. But, you know, there you are. You're in federal court, and that is never a situation that's not, you know, very, very stressful. It's never a situation that is not expensive. And it's a shame that when in a situation like this, where, as I've you know, tried to say convincingly, the vast majority of reasonable people would think that there's a good fair use argument to be made here. It's so unfortunate that notwithstanding our sensibilities in all of this stuff and that we want this remix culture to flourish and prosper, that there's such an easy way to get this taken down and there's no corresponding easy way to really dispute the fact that this may be legitimate content. It costs nothing, essentially, to send a DMCA takedown notice. You know, it's a one-page thing that just has to say three or four things. Lawyers, copyright lawyers, can do those things in their sleep. If you were to go fight this in court, that's a much different story. The obstacles or the effort that's involved in fighting these two sides of this battle are not proportional at all, and the way to resolve that is to somehow get those two things more in proportion. And I don't really know, you know, how to do that, because we don't want people sending more DMCA takedown notices than what they do. So we kind of want that to be maybe a little bit more burdensome, but we also don't want it to be so burdensome that infringing content, you know, does stay up when it really should be taken down. So I have no idea as to how to articulate, you know, a precise way of balancing this out a little bit better, but I certainly see that balancing and reproportioning of things is what needs to be done. So thank you, Jason, for giving us a great situation to have a meaningful discussion about the contours of fair use on the web. It's great.
Yes, you're probably not too happy to have been the person in the middle of that situation, though. Hey, Jason, we have a good suggestion from our IRC. Randy Nacall, 2002, wonders why you shouldn't get together with Scott Johnson, who's the co-host of Forecast with Tom Merritt here on Twit, and also a cartoonist over at Frog Pants Media, I believe. He's also a very funny guy, so thinks that for your going forward projects that maybe the two of you could do a good collaboration. And I'm curious about, for your going forward projects, if you know, you feel like you need to stay away from popular mainstream copyrighted material such as the Peanuts.
Well, maybe Peanuts for a while. Yeah, I think so. But that doesn't make me shy of doing something else.
Yeah.
It's really about, you know, some, you know, being entertaining and providing, you know, good content. I've been, you know, blogging for a while and doing various things on the internet, and my mantra has always been content is king. And if you can do something that people are interested in, and maybe it involves fair use issues, maybe it doesn't, but it's worth doing. And even if it does involve, you know, copyright or fair use issues, it's something that is worthy to be talked about. And I appreciate that even though Peanut Tweeter was taken down, that so many people have expressed such an interest in, you know, delving into what is fair use and what isn't. I've had a lot of people, you know, contacting me via Twitter and email and comments and such on the site, and saying that, you know, it's my duty to fight this and this and that, and
mm-hmm.
it's really not my duty to.
That's right.
And I kind of wish that there was somebody, you know, with a voice that would take an interest in things like fair use and can speak for, you know, the little guy. You know, someone like me who is just kind of doing this for fun, and, you know, people are liking it, and there's kind of a community that's built, and when these things are taken down, then you don't have anything left. So my next projects, yeah, I don't know yet. I've been a cartoonist doing completely original work before, and I certainly will probably do it again. As far as it involving a mashup or something, I don't know yet, but I wouldn't rule it out.
Couple of just periods on this discussion. One is, there's an interesting segment in that Yale Law Tech article about the copyrightability of tweets, where the author, and I'm not sure if the author is identified here. No, it doesn't look like they are. comes down on the side. We've gone back and forth over whether a tweet is copyrightable or not. They seem to be of the mind that that it could be, but that it would depend on the tweet. That, you know, more factual kinds of things would probably be outside the realm of copyright law, but more creative kinds of things would be within it. So, you know, you'd have to look at the substance and not just the length to determine the copyrightability of an individual tweet, which complicates things a good deal. Also, you know that Righthaven decision we discussed last week, where Righthaven got shut out for not having standing to bring its lawsuits because it, unlike Iconix here, was not assigned all of the rights that the plaintiffs had, or the would-be plaintiffs in these cases would have had, but instead simply a purported right to sue, which is not supposed to be capable of being carved out under the copyright law and assigned away. There was also a really interesting discussion in that decision that sort of got lost in the shuffle about how reposting the entire article at issue there was fair use in that instance. And it's pretty rare that the reposting of something verbatim gets taken as fair use, but there was a good discussion there about how that could happen and why it did or should have in that case. David, any thoughts on any of this before we move on?
Well, getting back to the Peanut Twitter case, you know, I definitely agree with Evan. I think it's tough from the perspective of a defendant in one of these cases to know when you have a fair use because of the ex ante nature of the fair use defense. You have to go through an entire a series, really, of judicial proceedings and have a judge ultimately determine that your use is a fair use. And if you look back historically at some of the other uses that have, you know, that we've had over time involving parodies, some of the cases are really, really close. And a judge can, you know, come down on one side or on the other side. It might just depend on what they eat for breakfast that day.
That's the problem with the whole fair use analysis in general. Well, I want to get to more problematic or interesting and controversial decisions. This one from the U.S. Supreme Court concerning California's attempt to outlaw violent video games for minors. But first, I'd like to thank Squarespace for sponsoring this episode of This Week in Law. Squarespace is the fast and easy way to create a high-quality website or blog. It has an easy-to-use UI. I use it for Bag and Baggage, my own personal blog, and it makes updating there just a joy. It makes it easy to manage a whole site, not just a blog page. You can have a gallery or a page of Amazon links, and we're going to get into some discussion about how motivated people in various states might be to include those links in a little while as the affiliates are getting shut off in various places. Squarespace is optimized for both beginners and CSS experts. Hundreds of design templates to choose from are there, and you can customize any of them to fit your needs exactly. The iPhone and iPad apps for updating your blog on the go are just great, totally intuitive and easy to use, and they get done everything you need to get done on the go. The online resources and support team give you personal help 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And it's an all-inclusive service, which includes several modules to build your website, a blog module, which includes import and export support for WordPress, Blogger, Movable Type, and Typepad. That means data portability, something else that Google Plus did really well out of the gate. We should talk about that before we wrap the show. Form Builder to collect email addresses and other information from site visitors. There's a Flickr photo display. You can choose a thumbnail or a slideshow view. There's a Twitter widget to display tweets on your website in a customizable and great-looking format. There are social media buttons to connect your website visitors to your networks on Facebook and Twitter, and you can bet Google Plus will be in there too as soon as it's out of this field test beta phase. Google Maps and more. Website tracking so you know how many times your site is viewed, and a built-in search engine optimizer to get yourself up there and where you need to be in those search engine results. Permission access handling, cloud architecture for speed and site stability. These things are rock solid. It's really hard to bring down a Squarespace site I double dog dare you to try. Use Squarespace for all your website needs. Build it, host it, and update it anytime. For a free trial, go to squarespace.com and sign up for a free account. You don't need a credit card. Just try it out and start building your site. Then if you decide to purchase it, use the offer code TWIL7 and you'll get 10% off for 6 months. That's squarespace.com. Use TWIL7, 10% off for 6 months. That's a great deal. Thank you so much, Squarespace, for your support of This Week in Law. So California, as we discussed on the show several months back, attempted to outlaw violent video games for minors in much the same way that you would outlaw a minor's ability to buy cigarettes or alcohol, say. You just simply wouldn't be able to buy them. It would be illegal for a vendor to sell such things to a minor. And the Supreme Court has just ruled that that law cannot stand, will not stand. And so I guess that's good news for kids in California if you are anxious to play your Call of Duty or what have you and your parents aren't policing the rating system so well. My own personal take on this, you know, as a parent and not necessarily as a constitutional scholar, is that the rating system functions well and does manage to accomplish what the California legislature was largely trying to accomplish. But that assumes active parents and, you know, fairly law-abiding or rule-abiding kids, I guess. And under a regime that does not have a bar like this, it is quite possible for children to get their hands on and play some pretty awful material when you're talking about kids who are under 10, say. And there's no criminal liability that's going to attach to that. So that's the upshot of the decision. Evan, what's your thinking on it?
One of the things that I love most about First Amendment cases, and this one is a great example of this notion that I'm talking about here, is how the arguments can really cut across and be agnostic to one's political position on all of this. There's something for everyone on both sides of this issue. For one, let's just say you want to take a liberal political position on this and say, you know, the information should be out there. There should be openness and you know, there should be no, you know, regulation of this stuff because, you know, we are thinking people and the information should flow freely. The content should flow freely. That's a liberal political position you can take. And I know I'm oversimplifying things and you know, doing that, but in any event, then there's also you could take the very conservative position. We don't want the government messing around with things and saying, you know, what should be able to be sold and what should not be able to be sold. You know, it's kind of an anti-paternalistic position that one could have against the government that's usually associated with more conservative ideologies. So that's one thing that I really like. My favorite thing about First Amendment cases like this when it comes to some kind of content restriction on things. And it sounds like the court made a justifiable decision here, looking to what test it was obligated to put in this situation. It was obligated to give strict scrutiny to the statute, which means that, you know, is there a compelling government interest that is to be met here, and if so, is that law tailored in such a way that it doesn't regulate more than what it needs to? And given that there was evidence that parental regulation was doing the job in keeping violent video game content out of the hands of minors and out of their field of vision and their scope of experience, then, you know, this statute was over inclusive, and so it sounds like that it was well reasoned. Justice Scalia, you know, wrote the majority opinion here. So, you know, if anything, whether you like Justice Scalia or not, you're going to know that he's going to abide by the rules when he's writing, an opinion and thinking this through. So It's just like so many of the issues that we talk about here. I like it because there are multiple ways of looking at it and several different sensibilities or several different bodies of doctrine or norms that you can come to feel good about the resolution of it. I guess accordingly, you feel just as good about an opposite result. Just kind of flipping things around in the analysis. It's a neat thing to think about.
John Stewart was not a big fan of the inconsistency in the decision as he sees it between banning material with sexual content from kids, but not the extremely violent stuff that can make its way into video games. And we have a clip from him from The Daily Show to that effect. I think. We see his face. There we go. I think the studio is having some net issues at the moment. But what he goes ahead and plays there is a segment from a game. I know not what game this is, but
say it.
I don't know what game he lifted this from, and he didn't tout it probably intentionally. So. But he plays it. There we go. Oh, yeah. So this woman just gets ripped into two in a bloody awful. That is from Mortal Kombat, I'm being told, in IRC. first, she gets pounded in the face such that all the skin goes flying off of her skull. And then she literally gets ripped in two in a really horrific way. So. His quip at the end of the clip was that, that one is just fine for kids to have, but if she'd had a little nipple slip, then, you know, of course that would be something that we'd want to keep away from the kiddies. So, David, any thoughts on this one?
Yeah. It's an interesting case, I think. Not a surprising decision in the end, based on the other cases that we've seen come through the Supreme Court on First Amendment-related issues. I guess a bit of a win for video games. Hey, look, they are actually expression under the First Amendment, so that's important. Mm-hmm. I think I align myself a bit with John Stewart in that I wonder when we as a society has reordered obscenity, sexual expression, to be worse than violence. And that seems to play an inherent role. Really, what California tried to do, the government was arguing that the standard that should apply, the standard of review, should be the obscenity standard. We should look to the Ginsburg case, I think it was Ginsburg v. New York, and instead of applying strict scrutiny, we're talking about the sale of materials to minors. It should be a lesser... less restrictive standard that should that the state has to meet. Unfortunately, of course, the Supreme Court did not side with them at all, and I guess it depends where you fall on the issue. And I don't know what to make of these studies either, which is another interesting part of this. The study really doesn't show much of a causal link. I looked at it briefly months ago when this was argued, and I think after the Ninth Circuit decision came out. But despite that, though, I think it's really hard to prove an actual causal relationship between violent materials, at least the consumption of those, and psychological effects on children. There might be something there. There might not be. I don't really know. But I guess in the end, maybe it's up to the parent to decide what's appropriate for their children. And the other problem, of course, was just that this law was likely to sweep in other forms of expression in video games that it wasn't trying to target. And for instance, it was a really strange law. So they had this funny definition of what it was to be obscene, at least in a video game, what was too violent, and it left out a bunch of things. It said nothing about killing aliens, for instance, since it used the phrase a human image. Does that mean like a humanoid image? If the alien then has, four limbs and a head, would that qualify under the statute? I don't know. It could, maybe, but maybe not, because it's not a human. And also animals, too, cruelty to animals. It didn't really speak anything about doing any of those very violent things to animals. And that's interesting to me also, because I think violence to either of those things, might very well, or it should have qualified probably under the statute. But it didn't seem to be terribly well written in the end.
Fopo Gijo in IRC has an interesting observation and thinks that if the law had stood, we would have increased the concentration of violence for the sake of violence video games, because there would have been certification fees in order to be rated, and indie developers would be less likely to be able to pay and more likely to make art. So Fopo Gijo says. So interesting observation there that maybe by leaving the arena for this less regulated, that you'll get more kinds of choices and not just the lowest common denominator. So let's talk next about, well, first I want to see if Jason has anything to say on this front before we move on from it. Jason, any thoughts on violent video games and their legality?
Well, as a parent, I firmly believe that I'm the one that should be deciding whether my child is going to be playing a video game like that. A video game rating is not there to be set a law put in place for. It's just not. It's a guideline for parents to make clean decisions on what their child is going to be playing. And it doesn't matter if it's a video game or if it's, you know, a YouTube video or some other site on the internet. I don't like the slippery slope that this kind of law would introduce, because it's really up to the parents to decide whether, you know, their kids are going to be playing a game like that. And for what it's worth, even if it was a law, kids are still going to find a way to play it. And
yep.
And so it's just a lie that just doesn't work.
Right. You're almost making it more attractive by outlawing it. And I like the notion, too, that of keeping this arena consistent with television and movies, too, which can be terribly violent in their own right, and simply have a rating system to protect young kids from being exposed. So if it's good enough for those arenas, I think it's good enough for the gaming one, too. Jason, I know you need to cut out and leave us. We're going to stay on with Evan and David and finish up the show, but we really appreciate you joining us. Please continue to tweet and let people know what your next project is and where can they follow along and make sure they stay up to speed on that.
Oh, thanks a lot. It's been really fun doing this. I can be reached on Twitter at Jagnalot. At least that's what it looks like it's pronounced as, Jagnellot, as well as that's my URL. So feel free to go on there and follow me, and I will probably follow you back.
Great. Thank you so much, Jason. We'll keep up with you out there in the Twitterverse and elsewhere. Take care.
All right. Thanks a lot.
I don't see you.
All right. So, David, tell us about hot news, another Supreme Court decision. What's hot with hot news?
Not much these days, because I think the Second Circuit looks like it wants to invalidate it. But they didn't, though, which is also significant in its own right. And it doesn't really seem like they had an opportunity to in this last case. And I'm, of course, talking about the Barclays v. theflyonthewall.com. They came out with this the decision was issued, I think, last week, and it seemed really constrained by the facts in the case. And first of all, they didn't have an opportunity to really opine on the validity of the hot news doctrine, which is sort of this pseudo property right, basically, that is afforded to news gatherers that have time sensitive information. And what happens apparently is that when companies, the news gatherers themselves, are investing a lot of time, resources, and money in actually obtaining newsworthy information, then shortly after publishing it, people come around and sort of steal it from them and then republish it themselves. At least this is what has been going on since the mid-1800s. And of course, there was the Supreme Court case in 1918, which sort of validated the principle of a hot news doctrine. If you fast forward a little bit into the 1976 Copyright Act, which was the next major overhaul after, I think, the 1909 Act, added a couple of interesting provisions which really neutered the hot news doctrine. The first, of course, was the fair use doctrine, which is now codified into the statute, and also Section 301, which is the express preemption section. And that section held that, you know, states could not recognize rights that were anything like equitable rights or the exclusive rights that are granted under the Copyright Act. And a hot news claim is very close to claiming an infringement based on the right to distribution under the Copyright Act, and that's the main problem with it. And since the late 70s, the doctrine has basically been chipped away at. I think there are only 5 states that still recognize it. New York is one, California is another, I think Missouri is in there, and then maybe a handful of others that I can't remember. But in the end, though, some people really want to revive this because online news has changed everything. The way that we consume news is entirely different than, you know, going out to the end of our driveway and picking up an actual paper newspaper. I don't even get a newspaper anymore. The way that I consume my news is I go to Google News and I kind of rely on the algorithm to tell me what is news. And sometimes the news that I'm reading isn't being broken by the entities that did all of the news gathering. And so if you think about the crisis, the state of crisis the newspaper industry is in right now, you know, people look to the hot news doctrine as being a potential savior for it. And you know, there's something to be said that, you know, these news gathering entities are expending a lot of resources, and because of the nature of the Copyright Act and infringement claims underneath it, the Copyright Act doesn't really afford very much protection for factual information. Mm-hmm. And on top of that, fair use, of course, classically recognizes news and commentary as being a very classic fair use. And so, again, going back to the ex ante nature of the fair use provisions in the Copyright Act, you don't know if something is a fair use until you get it before a judge, and the judge says, that's a fair use. And so it's sort of very difficult from a news gatherer's perspective to determine whether or not you should sue, especially if something is very factual in nature. So it might not even be protected under the Copyright Act. So now here we are with this new decision from the Second Circuit, and I don't know what's left to it. I mean, obviously it's still viable, kind of. The EFF described it last week, I think, as being on life support. Probably an accurate description because in its opinion, the Second Circuit said, you know, we don't know about the, you know, the validity of this doctrine, whether it's going to continue to be valid going forward. But it did say it would defer that that particular opinion, I think, to the New York Court of Appeals, which is, you know, the equivalent Supreme Court, but named a little funny.
Mm-hmm. Evan, is there any takeaway from this that you would give, just sort of a nice nugget for folks who are reusing news that has been broken by others on the web?
Well, yes. I think that to bring it within the scope of the discussion that this case gives us, I would reinforce the notion that this case, and I guess this would be underscoring something that David said, this case does not technically stand for the proposition that there is no such a thing as a claim for the misappropriation of hot news, but it is going to be very factually based. It's going to depend on what the republisher is doing here. And what we had in this case was the court found that the misappropriation of hot news claim was preempted by the Copyright Act because the plaintiff failed to show that there was that extra element to the cause of action that took it outside of the scope of things that copyright protects. Section 301 of the Copyright Act that David talks about there says that any, you know, equivalent state law cause of action, you know, will not be heard, and it should be, you know, the province of federal law. So what the analysis focused on here was whether or not there was any free riding going on here. And I think it may be, that's one of the elements of a misappropriation of hot news claim. And so I think it may be helpful in the modern day ecosystem of gathering content, aggregating it, and putting it out maybe in a slightly different form. I think it would be helpful to look at that, whether or not what the person is doing, what the republisher is doing here is truly free riding on the news gathering efforts that the original publisher undertook. In this case, the court found that there was no free riding because what the what the fly on the wall was doing was actually original news gathering. It was reporting on the recommendations for stock purchases that the investment firms were making. So the court found that the fly on the wall wasn't just essentially copying and doing this and thereby free riding on those efforts, but it was actually reporting as news what the investment firms were doing. So there's that's where the distinction, that's the important distinction that comes in here, and what made this one so peculiar, particular. And I think that particularity would be present in a lot of the models that somebody might come up on these days of, you know, going out, if you're going to, like, you know, appropriate content from various sources out there on the web, or run it through some system whereby it's automated, maybe tagged and contextualized in a certain way. It would seem that the analysis really needs to be what new is being done to this. Is this really a news gathering function that the republisher is doing, or is it just simply copying in the same format and for the same purposes as the original publisher? And so I think the takeaway would be looking at that, what really is the republisher doing in those terms?
Right. Hopefully adding a lot of gloss and commentary like we try and do here on Twill.
That's right.
Yes. One thing I want to talk about before we get through with the show today is the fact that Amazon affiliates are becoming an endangered species. But before we get to that, I would like to thank our second sponsor for episode 118 of This Week in Law, and that's Netflix. Netflix, of course, streams thousands of TV episodes and movies directly to you instantly, which means you save time, money, and hassle. There are several easy ways to instantly access streaming movies and TV shows with Netflix. You can watch Netflix movies and TV shows on your Mac or PC or iPad. The iPad app is absolutely a wonderful experience. You can watch on your iPhone and some Android phones too. If you have a gaming console, an Xbox 360, PS3, or Nintendo Wii, you can watch it right on your TV. And if you're not a gamer, you can watch Netflix on your TV with an Apple TV or a Roku or, I believe, Google TV. Are those still out there? I don't know. That would be an interesting thing to talk about integrating with Google Plus. And you can begin watching a movie or show on one device and then finish it on a different one. So, you know, Netflix totally gets the fact that it's not just one screen that we consume our entertainment on these days. We start in one place and end in another, and Netflix has you covered in that regard. Whichever way you choose to access Netflix, you can watch as many movies and TV shows as you want, anytime you want, and you can cancel anytime. So try it free for 30 days if you're not already a member. Go to netflix.com/twit. Be sure to use this URL when you sign up for your free trial. And we really thank Netflix for their support. They're a great service. We're all huge fans, and we're thrilled that they're part of our family here at Twit. So poor Amazon affiliates. They are just getting snuffed out of existence from state to state, the latest being California, with a bill that just passed here recently, and all the Amazon affiliates in California got an email updating them on the fact that the legislature was about to do this, and that it did in fact pass, and it has to do with the huge and difficult to resolve issue of sales tax and how that has to be accounted for. Of course, Amazon doesn't want to have to deal with the taxation issues that it hasn't had to previously, and doesn't want to begin having to account for what sales take place in California and should be subject to tax, and then make sure that California gets its cut. Of course, California being a bankrupt state and many others out there following suit think that this is something that's got to go. And so there have been a whole sort of domino kind of impact of different states doing this, California just being the latest. The Amazon solution has been to say, hey, you know, you affiliates, we know it's not your fault. You didn't enact this law, but we're going to have to make it up somewhere, and we're going to make it up by canceling our affiliate program in those states. So some interesting legal issues around this come up as, of course, the first consideration that affiliates and savvy computer users have is, you know, how do I get around this? Can I, someone over in Leo's Google Plus stream, actually, Jim Walkzak, wondered if there's anything illegal about, say, Leo and he, because Leo says he's going to lose about $1,000 a month in affiliate fees. Anything illegal about Leo and I or any out-of-state person signing an agreement so that he could use my Amazon code, or better yet, I would agree to pay him a fee, not less than commissions received, for the right to post Amazon links on his website. So if people you know, are trying to cobble together ways of gaming this and get around this physical nexus issue, I think at minimum that kind of a situation would be a violation of Amazon's terms of service and could result in the cancellation of both accounts. First of all, I want to know what's going on in Illinois and Massachusetts on this front. Evan, has Illinois followed suit?
Yes. I think it was in February. That sounds mm-hmm. about right. You know, the Governor Quinn here in Illinois signed a similar bill, and so Amazon immediately sent one of these emails out terminating these affiliate relationships immediately. So, you know, unlike Leo, I'll be losing out on, you know, maybe $4 every
right.
year.
Most of us are in that boat.
Right. It would be interesting to see data on how much people really are losing out on this. I don't know if you're aware of any, you know, I'm talking about, you know, big time affiliates, you know, how much are they being deprived of from the revocation of these, or the rescinding of these, rescinding, termination of these agreements. It seems really unfortunate that folks would be deprived of their livelihood here. I'm sure Amazon, you know, factored that into all of this. Clearly, they're going to be concerned about, at the end, their bottom line. What are the administrative costs that would go into actually paying sales tax on purchases like, or requiring the payment of sales tax on purchases like this, versus the loss of revenue and the loss of goodwill and the skin off their teeth from having terminated these agreements like this. So yeah, the same is true here in Illinois, and you know, I also have connections with Colorado. You know, a few months even earlier than that, I know that they terminated those accounts there. So it's right. It's crazy. It's just a falling away here. That's the perspective from here.
What's the deal in Massachusetts, David?
You know, I'm not positive on it, but I did read recently that we're considering a similar provision in our tax code that would require, you know, people like Amazon to start paying.
Right. Okay, well, any thoughts on the workarounds and how, you know, it's one thing to be able to turn off somebody's affiliate status based on the fact that their account information says they're in California, maybe their IP address does, but it seems like it wouldn't be too difficult to game that system.
Yeah, that's possible. It makes me very uncomfortable as a lawyer when people start talking about how they would get around something like that. Obviously, as you pointed out, you know, certainly it could be a violation of the terms of service, and that's effectively a contract, and that's something could potentially land you in court if there were any damages incurred by Amazon, or at, you know, at the least, you'd probably end up losing your account with Amazon. One other thing I wanted to note, I think, that's interesting is that a lot of people are in various states, residents are still required to claim items that they're purchasing on the internet and pay sales tax on them in the form of a use tax. That's something we have to do here in Massachusetts, I believe, and a lot of people, I think, don't do that, and that's one of the problems that underlies this, is that even though residents are required to pay taxes, at least in most cases, they don't, and that's why the state might be losing revenues.
Right. Okay, well, I feel bad for all those Amazon associates out there, including myself. My account was turned off, but again, this is just how Amazon has chosen to approach this, and we'll just have to see where it goes. I guess we will go on to our resource and tip of the week and begin to wrap up the show. Our resource is something we've referenced already in the show, and that is the Google Plus Privacy Guide. We'll put a link to that in the show notes. I assume that it is accessible because it is part of the google.com/support documentation. So even if you're not yet in Google Plus, I'm thinking that you'll probably be able to take a look at this and see that it is really, really nice and succinct. The defaults are good. They're mostly opt-in versus opt-out. And data liberation, as I referenced earlier when we were talking about Squarespace, is built right in. The data liberation front, Google's data liberation front, introduced something called Google Takeout this week, which is sort of a one-stop export feature. It has five services included out of the gate, where if you want to get all your data from those five services, including Google+, you can do that, and I think it comes to you as a zip file. So, you know, whereas it was really difficult to think about how you would get your video and photos, et cetera, out of Facebook, Google is addressing that nicely on the front end and making sure that not only are you going to be able to put stuff in, but you're going to be able to get it out too as a user, which is really nice. And our tip of the week, first I want to do a follow-up on last week's tip of the week, which had to do with the fairly raunchy, not safe for work site, Is Anyone Up? We had some interesting comments, and I'll just remind you that this is a site where people are submitting photos of folks they know in compromising situations, sexts, basically, and then submitting them after the fact to this site. You know, presumably they don't care much about the opinion of the person who sent it to them. And those photos are going up on this site and being aligned with somebody's Facebook profile, a screen grab of the Facebook profile, which is sort of disturbing on a number of fronts. Sean Chitwood wrote in to say that the proprietor of this site is very likely in violation of U.S. Code 2257, which requires detailed record keeping of nude models' names, ages, and consent forms. And he loves the idea that someone like this might face a lengthy legal battle against the Justice Department. And then Abby Beckert wrote to me and said he didn't understand how this nude photo hosting website was any different than YouTube, and why wouldn't it be protected under the DMCA? David, you want to field that one? Why doesn't the safe harbor protect somebody like this?
Oh, I'm sorry. I missed the first part. Could you go, could you say that again, please?
Sure. Let me toss this to Evan, because you might not have even listened to last week's show where we talked about this, but I know that Evan did. Do you think the DMCA would protect these folks, Evan?
No, not. This really isn't like YouTube in terms of its architecture. As I understand how the site works, is anyoneup.com works, is that users submit these photos to the site owner, who self-identifies as Hunter Moore. And then he makes the editorial decision as to what content to post. So there is an act of volition from the website operator to see that this content goes up, which is not present in services like YouTube, where you know, this is an automated, YouTube is an automated system. There's, you know, and we know that there's something like at least 24 hours of content uploaded to YouTube every minute. So this is different from YouTube, just in the orders of magnitude of the content that goes through there. YouTube doesn't make an editorial decision. It doesn't have to. Nobody sitting at YouTube headquarters has to press a button to approve this stuff to go online, whereas with this site, it's different. And so that takes it outside of the scope of Section 512 DMCA safe harbor protections, which says that this type of protection will, the safe harbor protection will attach to, among other people, hosts, interactive service providers, online service providers is the nomenclature here, who are hosting content at the direction of the user. The content is sent by a user, but it's not being presented on the web at the direction of the user. It's being presented on the web at the direction of the site operator, which differentiates this from YouTube and to that extent takes it outside, in my view, the scope of the DMCA safe harbor protections.
Right, and our tip of the week comes to us via Shani Jardin over at Boing Boing. You'll recall a few months ago, the New York Times raised its formidable paywall, And there were a number of JavaScript hacks and bookmarklets released that would help you get around that. But Shenny has linked to something even more straightforward, which we'll just go ahead and play for you, if we could. I don't think we have audio, but what you're seeing is someone pulling up a New York Times article and then going to the browser address bar and taking out all of the text in the URI after HTML and then refreshing. And that gets you around the paywall. And that's actually a strategy that defeats many, many paywalls. But this one, and Shenny, you know, was so great with her irony in saying, you will not believe the extremes to which hackers will go to defeat this strategy. It's a little bit of deleting text. So not so great on the New York Times part, but great for all of us who use it frequently. David, any thoughts on that one?
That's an interesting one. So you know, we do a lot of research at the Berkman Center where I work, and we are constantly having to cite URLs and footnotes and the like. Mm-hmm. And it's a huge pet peeve of mine when I have to deal with that post-HTML text in a URL. And I find that I'm constantly removing it because I know it's useless. It's usually just metrics that relate to the user, where they're coming from, whether it was coming from an RSS feed or something else. So I take it out, and you know, I kind of discovered this on my own. At the same time, after doing that and plugging the URL back into my browser just to make sure that the link still worked. So funny, it's an interesting thing, and it, you know, I wonder idly whether this might play into any of the anti-circumvention provisions in the DMCA. I know that might sound kind of absurd because we're just talking about a URL. We're not talking about DRM as it might protect a, you know, a music file or some sort of wrapping that might, you know, sort of envelope a news story. Since it's, we're just a URL, there aren't any encryption scrambling going on the backside. But still, you know, the access control protections. Some people have read that to be a lot of different things, including just a password. It might include if you are able to get around and use somebody else's password without permission, it's possible that you could have a violation of the anti-circumvention provisions just because it's so broadly worded. I'm not really sure where I fall on that. You know, I haven't really looked at it too closely. I think it would be an interesting issue. I think it sounds a little absurd, but you know, we've seen stranger arguments over the years, so who knows?
Yeah, we sure have. I hope we don't see that one, but like you, I wouldn't be surprised. Hey, Echo Android has a little comment in IRC that's worthy of the Wired Jargon Watch column. He says, changing URLs to get around security is now called doing a Citibank. So... On that note, we'll go ahead and say goodbye to you all. Have a lovely 4th of July weekend. Be safe out there with all of your pyrotechnics. David, where can folks find you? Not on the show.
You can find me at technicallylegal.org and on Twitter as @D_O'Brien, O-B-R-I-E-N.
Great. Thank you so much for joining us. And Evan, great to chat with you again.
Yes, same here. Always always great to talk with you. And David, good to talk with you as well. Glad we could have you on the show. And always, you know, always good to talk. Always very interesting. You're doing some great work out there at Technically Legal. Really enjoy that that content. So, yes, happy 4th of July, everybody.
Yes. And Evan, of course, does great work over at internetcases.com, his blog, and Internet Cases, his feed on Twitter. We have a Facebook page for This Week in Law where we post up questions that we'd love to get your feedback on before the show. That's at facebook.com/thisweekinlaw. And I'd love to hear from you in email, too. I'm denise@twit.tv and dhowell on Twitter. So hit me up either of those ways, and I'll get it. And I look forward to seeing you all next week. Take care.